The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. This is Mike Consul, and I'm joined by Prashant Tiwari, who is a partner with the Townsend Group, a consulting and investment firm to institutional investors, and Steve Cummings, who is senior partner and head of North American Investment Consulting for Aon. Recently, in fact, January, Townsend Group was acquired by Aon and is now a wholly owned subsidiary. Now, these two gentlemen have been doing a roadshow together in various cities and making presentations about the growth of real asset investment portfolios. That is what we're here to talk about today. Why is this happening? Why it makes sense? And where is real asset investment heading over the near term and maybe the longer term? Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
We're seeing more investors and organizations, your two organizations included, expanding into real assets. Talk a little bit about what is driving this expansion of real asset investing.
This is Steve. I'll start, and then Prashant, I'm sure you have a perspective on this. A couple of things are driving it, we think. One is our expectations and other consulting firms' expectations for the returns investors are likely to earn from traditional long-only stocks and bonds are lower than they have been historically. So as clients are looking for ways to achieve their investment objectives, and importantly, to do so in a way that's diversified, and therefore not increasing risk unduly, real assets are increasingly attractive to them for not only the diversification power that they bring to the portfolio of stocks and bonds, but also their level of expected return going forward.
That's indeed correct. I'd say maybe just add four things to it from a real estate asset standpoint. The first one is return, volatility, diversification, and income. If you look at the performance of the group of real assets, of which we include real estate, agriculture, timber, infrastructure, the longer-term returns have been very equity-like and higher. And so from a return standpoint, it's a good addition to the portfolio. The second dimension of volatility, traditionally these asset classes have had lower volatility and therefore it tends to lower the risk profile of the overall portfolio. The third thing is lack of diversification, a lack of correlation with the equities, which tends to be a big component of everybody's portfolio. And then lastly is the income component, which is pretty helpful, either from the standpoint of getting distribution out of these asset classes or from the standpoint of being able to provide a higher conviction in underwriting the returns that we expect to get.
So, Prashant, it's fair to say that the equities, and as you say, that tends to be the lion's share of a portfolio, has been on a very strong run for years, but the outlook for equities is a bit muted. Is that correct? And one of the reasons why real assets is offering something of a boost to portfolios?
We actually believe that the asset values across most of the asset classes have gone up, so the return expectations have come down, perhaps in equities, which I'm sure Steve can comment more on. But I will maybe talk a little bit about real assets. The return expectations relative to what has been realized over the last 4 or 5 years maybe is lower, and so I'd say more normalized return expectations. But the point I was making earlier was that when we look at longer-term return series, that's 10 years, 20 years, there is a moment where equity will outshine the real assets, another moment where the vice versa will take place. But over a long period of time, the return profiles of good quality real assets tends to be going hand-in-hand with the equities.
Yep, absolutely.
And good quality real assets. Steve, do you want to take that one? What constitutes good quality real assets? What are the categories that you guys are especially high on? And within any good category, there's better and there's worse. So could you speak to that a little bit, Steve?
The concept of high quality is a subjective one. It wasn't that long ago that most institutional investors limited their equity portfolios to long-only holdings in the Standard & Poor's 500. And anything else was deemed, you know, to be not high quality. And obviously, that's changed quite a bit over time. When we think about the non-real assets part of the world, generally when we're thinking about high quality, we're talking about good liquidity, good transparency, good price disclosure, which is pretty much true for all the developed markets on stocks and bonds, and increasingly components of the emerging markets. But I suspect your question is more specific to the real estate and real assets part of the spectrum. So, Prashant, you can probably take that one better than I.
Yeah, and I think, Steve, you provide a pretty good framework here with respect to how we should think about the quality aspect of it. And the story within real asset isn't very different from how it has panned out in the non-real asset side of things. When we're talking about very good quality real assets, the tests that we run for that is, are these assets that are highly desirable through good and bad economic environments? So as it relates to real estate, it could be very high quality real estate where the rental income may come down, but the occupancy tends to be very, very sticky because everybody wants to limit themselves to some really high quality locations that they want to live and work out of. And when we talk about some of the other real assets, the high quality infrastructure assets are the ones that tend to be in some kind of a regulatory regime where you are guaranteed a certain level of income because someone else cannot put up a competing infrastructure alongside. And the same thing in agriculture is highly productive lands that tend to be in fertile locations with good weather patterns. Those tend to be high-quality real assets, according to us.
Okay, now, Prashant, I think you covered most of the categories that you guys cited as being really the focal point: real estate, infrastructure, agriculture. And was there another was commodities the other category?
Timber.
Okay, very good. Now, you indicated, I attended your San Francisco event, and when I was there, I heard you guys indicate that 19% of institutional investors are significantly increasing allocations to real assets. My question is, are individual investors high net worth or ultra high net worth individuals and families also making any kind of significant moves in terms of upping their proportion of real assets? Do you guys have any information on the private and family investor as far as that goes?
We do have some visibility into that space. Our business is primarily serving institutional investors. I would say we definitely see on the private and high net worth side a keen interest to increasing allocation of those assets. Depending upon the size of the portfolio, sometimes it's difficult for them to do so economically. The vehicles are expensive or sometimes require minimum investment sizes. But to the extent there's a cost-effective way, we are seeing similar increases in that part of the marketplace, or desired intention to increase allocations.
I think, Steve, you hit the nail right on the head, that there is a very strong desire, but there are limitations with respect to what's available to an individual investor or a high net worth investor. From an execution standpoint, I would say this, that as time is going by, more and more alternatives are becoming available to high net worth and the individuals as well. So to give you an example, there are some what we call interval funds that are under development that would provide the high net worth and even the more average net worth individual out in the street access to these asset classes. We're quite deeply involved in the innovation along those product types. Additionally, there has been a significant expansion of individual balance sheets into agricultural investments, which we believe can sometimes be risky because they lack diversification. Individuals can go buy one or two farms. But I think what would be a more sophisticated way of investing, and one that is going to result into better diversification, is to invest in some of these products that have recently been introduced and are on the horizon to be introduced over the next year or two.
let's talk for a minute about what percentage of the portfolio pie real assets should account for. And by the way, just to step back, interval funds is something that our magazines have written about quite a bit, particularly Real Assets Advisor magazine. And already it's we see a lot of funds out there and a lot of them in registration. So point well taken, Prashant. What about the percentage of the portfolio pie for real assets currently? What percent do they account for, and what do you expect that to be, say, in 5 or 10 years? And we can just stick with the institutional part of the investment community right now. So what about that? The average portfolio for an institutional investor would be what now, and where do you think it might be in 5 or 10 years? Steve, do you want to take that one?
So one of the things that we all need to be aware of when we look at these averages, it is often embedded in those numbers, depending upon who's quoting them, are a fair number of organizations that have zero allocation to real assets, real estate, real assets, and private equity, for instance. And so for reasons that may have nothing to do with the characteristics of the asset class, it may have to do with governance restrictions or their need for liquidity. But for those investors that have made an explicit allocation to real assets, today we're typically seeing still a fair amount of dispersion. Anywhere from 5 to 20% would be a pretty typical allocation. In terms of where it's going, well, most of our clients are thinking about at least a 5 to 10 percentage point increase in that category over the next 5 to 6 years. And Prashant, what would you add to that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is totally the direction. We have been engaged over the last 24 months in many conversations with the clients at various stages of expanding their real asset programs. So many of them, and we work a lot with those who do actually have the real, at least a real estate allocation. So we're seeing them either expand their allocation to real estate or expand it outside of real estate, and they typically tend to pick either infrastructure or agriculture as the next step. Some of our clients actually do have real asset allocations as well. Some of them tend to have an agriculture allocation already or an infrastructure allocation already. And those who are in that category are considering or have recently added to their program an allocation to the asset, the real asset class they do not currently have an allocation to. So we're seeing a considerable push that is taking place in that direction. And it would take the normal time that it takes to get these things through the process as they work their way through a general consultant, and then they try and get the allocation and then eventually work with a more specialized consultant that is focused more on the real asset side. So in due course of time, we certainly will see these expansions increase, and it's the groundwork for that is already underway right now.
What real asset classes are showing particularly strong growth? Obviously, real estate has done really well since the global financial crisis. What other categories would you point to? And let me also throw energy in there. Just ask about energy, because that's not on your list unless you're counting fossil fuels under commodities. Is energy just simply too hard to pick the winners at this point with all the volatility in fossil fuel prices and then the not knowing who the winners might be in renewables?
So there are two questions that you asked. One was sort of more general about sort of where and within the real assets are we seeing the opportunities, and then the second one more specific to the energy, and I'm going to sort of address that in that sequence. With respect to real assets, these asset classes are becoming institutionalized at even greater level than they have been in the past. And so there are new opportunities across the entire spectrum. In real estate, for the longest period of time, institutional investors have relied on the four traditional food groups that includes offices, industrial, retail, and multifamily or the apartments. Those have been the traditional food groups. We've seen a lot of institutionalization taking place in asset classes like self-storage, data centers, medical business offices, senior housing, student housing, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot more different types of real estate sectors that have becoming institutionalized, which has been the focus of a number of investors and those who are more innovative and creative in their investments, like us, have been quite focused on those areas within the traditional real estate. Outside of that, in infrastructure, and I think this would hit a little bit towards your point about energy as well, there has been a lot of interest that has gone into very high quality core infrastructure, more as a substitute for fixed income. Our focus has been on areas like the renewables, like the middle market infrastructure that has attracted attention, but it has not attracted the attention to the same degree as the more core infrastructure has. And so we've relied on renewable projects where there is a guarantee of an offtake, where the land acquisition has been in place. Once those elements have been de-risked, our investors have gone in and provided the capital. And so that has been a very, very attractive growth area. And then in agriculture, a lot of attention in the past has gone towards the traditional row crops, which includes the corn and the soy and the rice and so on and so forth. Our focus has been to invest in areas like the blueberries, pistachios, hazelnuts, oranges, those areas that have traditionally been neglected but produce very, very high income. So as we look across the entire spectrum, the opportunity set it keeps changing, but these asset classes are evolving, and it is pretty important to remain on top of those. That evolution trend to make the best return for the capital that gets invested. To your second question about energy and investing more directly in energy, our investors have typically stayed away from that more because it is a commodity type investment. And while commodities do get included in the broader definition of what constitutes real assets, for the moment we think that they have been quite volatile. We're able to achieve similar return objectives at lower volatility by accessing something similar either through agricultural investments or through infrastructure investments. So we haven't traditionally exposed our client capital directly to commodity type investments that includes that broader energy sector as you're talking about.
Let's talk about the major considerations that investors need to take into account when they're thinking in terms of investing in real assets. There are a lot of portfolios, especially among individuals and families, that contain virtually nothing in the way of real assets. So if they're thinking seriously about this, what are the major considerations that they need to really take into account before making that move?
We always start with the holistic question of what is the investor's objective and what are the constraints that they face in terms of trying to achieve that objective. And those can vary quite dramatically from a closed, frozen corporate pension fund sponsor that would like to de-risk a string of liabilities to a university endowment with high expectations for growth in corpus and little sensitivity to liquidity. And once you start exploring the circumstances of the investor, then we like to help them use a very, very broad set of investment possibilities, which would include long-only stocks and bonds, alternative investments such as hedge funds, private equity, real estate, and then think about how to combine those effectively and efficiently in a way that increases the chance of that investor achieving their ultimate objectives. As it relates to real estate or real assets versus marketable securities, I know one of the considerations is liquidity and the nature of the relationship that the investor has with the folks that are doing the investing. And Prashant, you can probably give that a little more color.
Yeah, absolutely. So applying that framework within real assets, Steve started off with what are the investment objectives. If the objective is long-term growth at lower volatility versus trying to generate a lot of income along the way, those two investment objectives, and there could be plenty others, would result into different real assets and different different investment types. So starting off with what exactly are the investment objectives, how important is liquidity, and those considerations become really, really important and germane in terms of constructing these portfolios within real assets, because fundamentally these are illiquid asset classes at the end of the day, and there are mechanisms by which we can add liquidity to these asset classes, most importantly the listed universe that exists for both real estate as well as infrastructure, but that comes at a pretty heavy price of very high volatility relative to the volatility of the underlying private investments. So that's an important consideration from the investment standpoint. The second consideration that I think is relatively important is from the execution standpoint. So we talked about a lot of important characteristics. We talked about good returns, lower volatility, good diversification benefits, income potential. But when it gets down to picking out the actual execution, it requires understanding of these asset classes at least a certain level of depth, which means that for an institutional investor, it would have implication on the size of the staff that they have who's looking at these investments. So that becomes a pretty important consideration. And then lastly is that the range of options that are available could be somewhat limited in certain asset classes. And so getting the desired, constructing the desired portfolio may prove a little bit more challenging. However, as these institutions are getting more and more sophisticated, they are building up the required investment bandwidth at the staff level, and the range of execution alternatives seems to be increasing by the year. So some of these concerns are subsiding, but nevertheless are important considerations as people think about how to include real assets within the portfolio. A lot of these considerations would be very similar for an individual and a high net worth investor as well. They would probably have to address these same considerations as well.
Steve Cummings, so what kind of investment time horizon do investors need to allow for when investing in real assets? And I ask that because I think that is a hesitation of many investors, that we're talking oftentimes illiquid assets in a hold period, and that gives pause to certain people. There's a lot of people in organizations that just have an aversion to the idea of having their money tied up. What do they need to allow for? What kind of mindset do they have to get into if they're going to get serious about real assets?
Sort of two ways to answer the question. There's just the actual contractual time period that goes along with certain investment vehicles, closed-end funds, for instance, that that you know have associated with breaking them, you know, sometimes very, very severe penalties. But I think the real answer to your question is investors shouldn't lightly go into any investment idea. And the more committed they have to be to it, the more thoughtful they should be before entering it. We generally don't like to think about asset class level commitments that an investor is going to make for anything less than 10 years. Now, you might have an opportunistic tilt to a certain type of asset class that is, you know, very short-lived, but in terms of making an institutional or an investment commitment to real estate or private equity or real assets, we encourage clients to think of at least a 10-year time horizon, and if they're capable of thinking in terms of multi-decades, 20 years or more is not an inappropriately long period of time.
Look, there is a as I said earlier, these asset classes are fundamentally illiquid, and because they're illiquid, investors who want to come into these asset classes have to know that coming in. And it has important implications because it requires a little bit more thoughtful approach of investing. Once the investment is made, it is usually difficult to pull yourself out of it, and so it So it does require a little bit more upfront work. Also, because I mentioned that some of these asset classes may be new to certain investors, so there are a lot of real estate investors, but Steve pointed out that there are many that don't even have a real estate allocation today. So it's probably a newer asset class to many, but we work with a lot of sort of experienced real estate investors, but these experienced real estate investors may be new to either agriculture or infrastructure. So as people are looking into diversifying outside of the asset classes they're used to, it would have implication and bearing on the amount of time it takes to actually make the decision. And then once you make the decision, you typically live with it from sometime between 5 to 10 years. But if the programs where you do have the ability to do so, the rewards, the financial rewards that I pointed out along those four dimensions of return, volatility, diversification, and income are pretty compelling.
Prashant Tiwari, let's stick with you on this next question, which I think you kind of addressed this earlier, but I want to maybe channel this one a little bit more, and that is, how have real assets performed during the past 5 or 10 years, especially vis-a-vis, say, equities and traditional assets?
Yeah, so I think depending on the time period we select, 10-year, 5-year, some asset classes will perform a little bit better, the others will perform a little bit worse. But over time, good quality core real assets have performed around the similar level as equities over a longer period of time, just as a general rule of thumb. I would provide a little bit more color to that, since I think it is important. Over time, within real assets, investors can choose different risk profiles that have different return profiles associated with them. So what I just said applies to good core real assets, but most of these real asset classes provide a non-core component that has a higher risk associated with it. And in the past, history has demonstrated that the returns realized are also commensurately higher, which is a good outcome for the investors. So picking and choosing the risk spots within real assets become important. These real assets also behave differently. So during the financial crisis, the broader equities market took a nosedive. The real estate also corrected significantly, but a lot of that correction was cushioned by the income that was being generated, and so the decline wasn't as steep as in some of the other asset classes. But over that period of time, infrastructure and agriculture, particularly agriculture, held up in the positive territory, one of the very, very few asset classes over the financial crisis that ensued after the Lehman crisis was a very rare asset class to be in that position. The reason it behaved that well is because it was producing a lot of income. And that is the diversification benefit at its best. I think another important question that's somewhat implied in the question you asked is what do we expect the future to hold for these asset classes? So some of the returns are normalizing, as I'd mentioned earlier, but they continue to be strong, and our return expectations for core real estate is somewhere in the 6.5% to maybe even 7% kind of range, with about 60 to 70% of that return coming from generation of just current income. Some of the other real asset classes around the same level, but it is possible that that the specific parts of agriculture and some of these specific areas within infrastructure can even perform better than these numbers. So that's obviously is the investment priorities to identify those specific themes and drive our client capital towards those themes.
Well, speaking of real assets acting differently, which you brushed against, Prashant, let's talk about timber for a minute, because timber is one of those investments where they say you have to have the patience of a tree. Steve, could you address why timber is part of the mix here and what it does for a portfolio? Traditionally, I believe it has not returned a very high percentage, but perhaps its role is a little bit different than that.
When you ask a question like that, the first way we like to answer it is because it's different. We were making similar arguments last year when we were introducing the concept of insurance-linked securities to clients, because the return on those securities is highly correlated with natural disasters, but not particularly highly correlated with the return of the stock market or interest rates. And when you think about timber and agriculture in particular, the things that drive the return streams and the income streams from those types of investments are going to look and feel different than the return and income streams that you might get from the four traditional real estate categories that Prashant described earlier.
Right. No, I'd build on that a little bit, and I'd say that, look, the returns have to be commensurate with the risk, and if the asset that an investor owns today is a tree that grows timber and is harvested when you want it, and you can leave it on the tree if you don't need it today, that optionality does not exist in any other real asset class. And I can't think of any other asset class where you have the optionality of, I'll take my return today if I need it, or I'll take my return 3 years down. And by the way, if I do take my returns off of that one tree today versus taking 3 years from now, I haven't foregone that income. I've just decided to pick when I need that income. And because it is an asset class that allows the investor to do that, traditionally there is no debt on this asset class. So a number of times when we're looking at the return from other asset classes and comparing that to timber and finding that timber returns are lower, we need to adjust for the fact that this is an completely unlevered return. Our expectation of returns from timber is not that dissimilar from the returns that have materialized over the last several years, which is around 5 to 6.5%. But being able to get an unlevered return almost entirely from income in that range is a pretty compelling return in today's environment. So I feel differently about timber. I think that it has one of the lowest volatility of all the other real asset classes for the reasons I just mentioned. It remains unlevered, and you can postpone your income without having to lose your income. So I think that timber has that role, and this is a position more for the institutional investors who do have the patience of the tree because they are building long-term portfolios. But the reason of disappointment in timber in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years has not been relating to whatever timber has or hasn't done. It is more relates to the expectations that investors had out of this asset class, which were unfounded. So this asset class is not designed to produce double-digit returns, which is where the expectations were set. Those expectations didn't quite materialize, but what did materialize was a return that was more commensurate with the lower risk that this asset class has.
Interesting. Okay. Well, let's talk about then this recent seminar you had in San Francisco, because the two of you called the world more complicated and opportunistic. Now, I don't think anybody would argue the world's not more complicated. Being opportunistic tends to imply that you're taking risk. I think of a complicated situation as risky, and then on top of that, being opportunistic. So can you explain that one a little bit? When you say that the world's more complicated and opportunistic, what do you mean by that?
The complicated part is easier. I mean, there's more investment types. Investors are increasingly comfortable looking beyond their own borders for global diversification across different investment opportunities. So it's pretty easy to see how the world has become more complicated in terms of the potential components of an investment program and the different ways that one can get exposure to it. The opportunistic part of your question is probably the more interesting one. One of the things that we've encouraged our clients to do is to think of their investment program in a fluid way, not in a rigid way. And what we mean by that is there's certain areas of the investment landscape of high-yield fixed income securities, for instance, or emerging market debt, or other parts of the landscape that might be temporarily very attractive or very unattractive. And so we believe, and one of the reasons we have such a large research team focusing on these things, that investors that are willing and able to adapt their investment program to take advantage of dislocations in valuations or components of the market will be able to add value above and beyond those investors that, you know, are essentially passive participants in a static asset allocation in general across all types of investment.
I think both those things that you mentioned, Steve, apply very directly to the real assets. I mentioned earlier that there traditionally were four food groups, and now I within real estate, those areas where we can invest have significantly expanded. What has also expanded are the risk categories for those investments. Used to be core, non-core. Now it expanded to become core, value-add, opportunistic, and lately it's core, core plus, value-add, opportunistic, good quality debt, high yielding debt, mezzanine, preferred equity strategies. So the world has indeed become far more complicated. But with the complications comes the downside of needing more, again, the investment bandwidth to understand all these different opportunities. But I think hidden within this are some very good investment opportunities, because invariably the market drifts towards the lower risk, those investments that do not require a lot of time to underwrite. And what gets left behind are some really good, compelling opportunities that that an investor who is willing to take the time to understand those opportunities can really benefit longer term. One thing that Steve mentioned that really applies within real assets is the investors need to be able to move quickly and swiftly to take advantage of that, because such kind of opportunities don't last for a long time. And once discovered, and then a lot of capital starts flowing behind that. So speed is of the essence in many of these situations, but I look at the complicated investment environment that we're in today more as an opportunity to be able to identify those hidden jewels amongst a range of other opportunities where a lot of capital is being plowed in. I think that this would provide the investors that are willing to move fast a pretty good return for the capital that they put to work.
Final question, real assets or no real assets, what do you see as the primary challenges investors are facing during the next 5 to 10 years? And I think you've obviously hit on some of these. If you were to kind of summarize them, what are those major challenges that investors are facing?
Well, one we've touched on a couple times already, and Prashant mentioned it at the outset of the call. We've seen valuations across most major investment opportunities go up in recent years. We've had a pretty good run, and that's why, as we think about looking forward, we're increasingly advising clients to be prepared to live in a world of diminished return expectations, and their needs for returns don't tend to be perfectly correlated with the ones that the market produces. So I think valuation is probably one of the biggest concerns we have about investments generally around the world. And you know, it's been an awful long time since we've had a meaningful equity market correction, and whether one's around the corner or not is anybody's guess, but we have to believe that one will occur at some point. And one of the reasons we're particularly enthusiastic about seeing clients increasing their allocation to non-marketable equities is to provide some of that downside protection in the inevitable event of that stock market correction. What would you add, Prashant?
Yeah, no, I would say something very, very similar, actually, because I think that's indeed one of the biggest challenges. It is, what is the new investment framework for expected returns longer term? That has had very confusing signals. There was a time not that long ago when we had interest rates firmly in the negative territory across a very wide section of the market that included areas like Germany, but many other European countries as well, also included Japan as part of that mix. I have not seen a more confusing period in our investment history than that, because it's literally equivalent of pulling up at a gas station and having somebody else pay you to fill gas in your own tank. That's the equivalent of a negative interest rate. And so we've now coming out of that environment, And we were, and in a very relatively short period of time, we have seen interest rates start to go up, but nowhere close to where they have been in the past. And every time the market is asking the question, what is the long-term return expectations? And this is not just a real estate, real asset, or equity-related thing. This does include the bond market as well. And the signals on that front are not very, very stable. So if we're in the world where we're going to have 2% growth and 2% inflation, then why are the treasuries not yielding 4% today? That's what my macroeconomics 101 would tell me. Have the demographic trends changed so significantly that we need to recalibrate our long-term return expectations? In an asset class like real assets, where we're determining the value of a physical asset, those questions and the answers to those questions could drive valuations one way or the other by as much as plus minus 20%. So when we live in that world, that becomes a pretty challenging environment. I think when you ask this question, it's also important to kind of outline how we are reacting to that environment, that uncertainty. That is really important. I think one of those things is something that Steve alluded to earlier, is in this complicated world, be more opportunistic and try and get high returns by doing that additional work, because that extra return could come in helpful if the investment framework does change upon you in an unexpected manner. The second thing is to try and front-load your return as much as possible in the form of income, which is something that real assets provides a pretty good opportunity for an investor to do. So we're looking at investments where they're either generating income, in most of the cases, either today, and if not, then they're generating that income in the first year or two of commission of that investment, as opposed to making an investment of the type where we're going to go build a building, it's going to be built in 5-6 years, and it's going to be leased out over the next 2 or 3 years, and boom, all of a sudden in 10 years' time, we're going to have a pretty valuable asset in our hands. That's something that we're trying to shy away from in this environment.
One other thing that I would add on that front, in your comments, Prashant, just reminded me that we haven't talked about it, but one of the things that we spend a great deal of time and attention to is the cost structure, the fees that the clients are incurring. And just like front-loading that return in the form of an income component of your investment result, making sure that you've aggressively negotiated fees and are paying as little as you need to in order to achieve the desired result, is immediate money saved if you're able to be disciplined on that front, as well as getting those returns front-loaded as much as possible.
Our guests have been Prashant Tiwari and Steve Cummings. They are executives with the Townsend Group and Aon, respectively. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks a lot, Mike.